It's Thursday, February 11th. It's not 100%, but it's pretty close. We start here. In a study that could save lives, the CDC says there is a way to cut transmission of COVID by up to 95%.
Wearing a mask is good, but making sure it fits properly is really important.
It's not just what masks you wear, it's how you wear them. Some senators didn't know just how close the danger was until they saw the tape.
They were within 100 feet of where the vice president was sheltering with his family.
We'll walk you through the impeachment trial presentation that shook so many in the room. And President Biden says he'll defend democracy abroad, but how far is he willing to go?
This external pressure may not really do anything at the end of the day.
The new decision to punish the perpetrators of a coup. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. In recent weeks, you might have seen someone at the grocery store wearing not just that homemade cloth mask they had always brought, but a second surgical mask underneath.
We're hearing about multiple cases of the UK variant documented in New Jersey.
And California today reporting its first two cases of the more contagious South African variant.
In many cases, this double masking has been a reaction to these worrisome new variants, which are even more contagious than what was already one of the most contagious viruses we've ever seen. And medical professionals have said, yeah, you know, second mask, it's probably a good idea, couldn't hurt. But up until now, the U.S. government had not actually said whether that would protect the wearer or not. That kind of changed yesterday.
The new CDC report showing that tightly fitted masks make a difference, and that a tightly fitted mask with a cloth mask over it, double masking as it's called, is also effective.
A new study from the CDC suggested that double masking, putting a second mask on you that fits really tightly, actually can protect you from COVID better than a single mask. Let's get some info on this. We got someone who ran the CDC at one point. Dr. Richard Besser was the former acting director there. He now leads the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Dr. Besser, can we start with the practical stuff? What is the current recommendation at this point when it comes to wearing masks? Like, how many do we need? What type do we need?
Right. Well, you know, Brad, at the highest level, the recommendation is that everybody should be wearing masks.
I'm glad that we have a reasonable thinking governor who has lifted the mandate. I don't wear a mask unless I am made to.
I see so many people today who aren't wearing any mask. Right. And even wearing a single mask will reduce the likelihood that if you have COVID, you'll spread it to someone else, and will reduce the chances that if someone near you has COVID, that you will breathe it in and get infected.
New data released from CDC today underscore the importance of wearing a mask correctly.
What the CDC said in their study, and this was published in the MMWR, which is their journal of record, is that wearing a cloth mask on top of a surgical mask or a medical procedure mask, they're the same thing, will improve the fit. And that's what this is about. When you put a mask on, there are gaps around the side of that mask. There may be gaps around your nose. But if you wear a surgical mask that has a wire at the top and you pinch it on your nose and you put a cloth mask on top of that, it will ensure that there aren't the leakages around the sides of that surgical mask.
Like the surgical mask does a lot of the work, and then the cloth is there to press it against your mouth.
Exactly, because if you just put on a surgical mask without doing anything else, what you're going to find is that it doesn't fit really tightly on the sides. There are big gaps there. But that cloth mask, if it fits properly over your ears, will hold that surgical mask in place. And in their studies, they found that this reduced the amount of particles by over 90%.
Wow. Well-fitting masks provided the greatest performance both at blocking emitted aerosols and exposure of aerosols to the receiver.
They cautioned, though, that don't take those numbers and assume they're going to apply to you, because they tested one type of cloth mask and one type of surgical mask. But the general principle is a good one, that wearing a cloth mask over a surgical mask will help. They give some other alternatives as well.
This includes wearing a mask with a moldable nose wire, knotting the ear loops on your mask.
You can knot the sides of a surgical mask. And if you go to their website, they'll show you what they mean by that, so that it will fit better on the sides of your face. Or you can purchase what's called a mask fitter, which is like a plastic or nylon device that goes over your mask that helps it fit on your face a little
better. It looks like the neck gaiters that we're always saying. They're not great masks, but this looks like a neck gaiter. It's good for that.
Yeah, some of them are neck gaiters and some are like a plastic frame that holds it on your face. But the takeaway from it is really this, that wearing a mask is good, but making sure it fits properly is really important and will increase the benefits that you get.
Well, so I understand that scientific conclusions change with more data, right? I get that. But just so we're clear, can we walk this back? Early on, the CDC was saying, hey, we have no reason to recommend masks. We haven't seen any. In July of last year, data does come in. They change it to, well, we do recommend masks. It's really there to protect other people, though. It won't necessarily protect you. Then November comes around. They're like, oh, actually, it does protect you. We've started to see that data. And now, a full year after COVID reaches American shores, they say, oh, actually, not just one mask, two masks are actually really good. Is that counterproductive at one point when we feel like the guidance shifts month after month?
Well, you know, one of the advantages we have now that we didn't have last year is that we're having CDC scientists out front explaining what they're learning.
I know some of you are both tired of hearing about masks as well as tired of wearing them. Masks can be cumbersome. They can be inconvenient.
The goal of mask wearing is not to make your life less comfortable.
And we're seeing our political leaders stand up and say the exact same thing.
In the next few months, masks, not vaccines, are the best defense against COVID-19.
And hopefully that will allow people to take this in and say, you know, I've been hearing a lot about these strains of the virus, these mutants that can spread more easily. There's actually something I can do until I get vaccinated. Hopefully that will help people, you know, not feel like no one knows what they're doing, but feel like people are providing answers as this is changing. And that is a good thing.
We can adapt ever so slightly if we need to.
That's right.
Hey, you talked about political leaders and being upfront with what their goals are here. Can we talk about schools for a second? Because we've seen teachers at this point say they still don't feel safe teaching students in person, right? The Biden administration had said during the campaign, said after inauguration, we got this 100-day plan for opening schools. Well, then yesterday, it sounds more like within 100 days, they're hoping to get, I think it's half of schools doing in-person classes one day a week. That's the 100-day goal? What are you seeing as far as opening schools right now?
Well, I'm seeing a lot of people who are really worried. A lot of people are scared.
We know that we have children literally sleeping away the most pivotal times of their lives when they should be getting educated.
Teachers are feeling uneasy about recent safety measures, such as the use of fans for ventilation in schools.
There is a plan to get schools and young people back. It does not consist of a $20 fan from Home Depot.
What gives me hope is that the science is lining up to say that if schools are given the resources that they need, and a lot of schools aren't, especially schools in lower income neighborhoods, schools that serve black and brown children, but if schools get the resources they need, you can get children into school learning safely.
The CDC mentioned in the White House COVID-19 briefing Monday morning, the data reflects more school cases coming from community breaches of COVID than transmission between students.
Fans are no plan, and vaccinate to educate.
Teachers should be vaccinated because that will add another layer.
That was
on
my
top.
Question is, should a teacher get vaccinated before they go into that classroom, though, even if you think it's a little safer than whatever, the living room?
Well, you know, my takeaway is that you don't need that in order for school to be open safely. But I think that it's really important that as states are gearing up and vaccinating, that they follow the guidance that was laid out by CDC.
I'm ready. I'm 100% ready for it.
I think teachers should be in line. You know, they should be in line ahead of people who can work remotely from home. But the good news is that given the proper resources in schools, and a lot of schools have those resources, you can open in a safe way.
And we're actually waiting on what the CDC has said might be new guidance for schools, how to safely open them and keep students and staff safe. Still waiting on that guidance. But this new data on masks, this new study showing you exactly how effective double masking, pressing that surgical mask on your mouth can be. It's a big deal. Dr. Richard Besser, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Now, Next up on Start Here, there was a big lie, but there were lots of smaller lies along the way, breaking down one of the most affecting days in impeachment history after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Some people think this trial is a contest of lawyers, or even worse, a competition between political parties. It's neither. It's a moment of truth for America.
Yesterday, the impeachment trial of President Trump really got underway in earnest. This was opening argument time.
Donald Trump surrendered his role as commander-in-chief and became the inciter-in-chief.
What we've seen in polling is before this began, a little over half of Americans thought that President Trump should be convicted of inciting an insurrection. But for an impeachment conviction, you don't need to get the vote of half the senators. You need two-thirds of them, an overwhelming majority. Now, there are lots of Americans, and lots of Republican senators for that matter, who would agree that President Trump's words were irresponsible, that he shouldn't have said what he said to his supporters on January 6th. But that's a lot different from saying he incited these people, that he in some way directed the actual violence. Well, that is the case that impeachment managers from the House began to try to piece together yesterday. ABC's White House correspondent Mary Alice Parks is with us. And Mary Alice, I mean, they had 8 hours yesterday. They have another 8 hours today if they want it. Again, we saw like a ton of video clips from January 6th. But out of what I'm sure are thousands of hours of footage, what is the central argument that they're trying to piece together here?
Brad, they're trying to say that the violence on that day was even worse than people realized in the moment.
They're throwing metal poles at us. 150, give me yourself, your nails, yourself.
As horrific as it was, 140 officers injured, three officers who ultimately lost their lives. We all know that awful day could have been so much worse.
They're also trying to show in by piecing together a very detailed timeline, minute by minute of that day, what President Trump did not do on that day.
So go home. We love you. You're very special.
Nowhere in that video, not once, did he say, I condemn this insurrection. I condemn what you did today. Nowhere did he say, I'm sending help immediately. Stop this.
But the third big pillar of their argument, which doesn't include the shocking and startling video, but is perhaps actually the meat of their argument, is everything that happened before January 6th.
On May 24th, 6 months before the election, he tweeted, it will be the greatest rigged election in history. On July 30th, 2020 will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. Again, just big words with nothing to prove them.
They're building off of open source material when President Trump was already starting to cast doubt on whether or not the election would be free and fair.
I'm a Texas Democrat. We've lost a few elections over the years. But can you imagine telling your supporters that the only way you could possibly lose is if an American election was rigged and stolen from you.
There was this moment on the presidential during the presidential campaign when some Trump supporters really harassed a Biden campaign supporters and Biden campaign staff on a freeway.
For anyone who says Donald Trump didn't know the violence he was inciting, I ask you to consider his supporters tried to drive a bus off the highway in the middle of the day to intimidate his opponent's campaign workers. And his response was to tweet the video of the incident that had fight music, joke about it, and call those individuals in that incident patriots.
When he, right after votes started to come in, was already saying that he thought it was rigged.
This is an embarrassment to our country. We were getting ready to win this election. Frankly, we did win this election.
He doused the flames with kerosene.
Democrats laid them out in this timeline that really started to just sink in and have unbelievable crescendo there in the room.
The president had every reason to know that this would happen because he assembled the mob, he summoned the mob, and he incited the mob.
Okay, so that's the idea that President Trump deliberately, like methodically laid the groundwork for this. It also seemed just like, this isn't a legal point, I guess, but like they were just trying to remind people this was an attack. Like this wasn't a protest. It wasn't even a riot. Like they really described this as, I guess, an assassination attempt.
Yeah, they had this unbelievable video that we hadn't seen before that showed just how deep inside the Capitol so many of those insurrectionists got.
As Pence was being evacuated, rioters started to spread throughout the Capitol.
Additional security footage shows how Leader Schumer and the members of his protective detail had a near miss with the mob. They came within just yards of rioters and had to turn around.
They're in real time trying to avoid people that are talking about wanting to kill them.
Pence lied to us. He's a total treasonous pig.
Nancy! Where are you, Nancy?
The speaker was not just rushed from the floor. The Capitol Police deemed the threat so dangerous that they evacuated her entirely from the Capitol complex.
And to see that play out was terrifying. Oh, shocking.
You all may have seen footage of Officer Goodman previously, but there's more to his heroic story.
You'll probably remember Officer Goodman. You've seen him in a lot of those pieces of footage that have come to light where he sort of worked with his baton to direct the mob away from where Vice President Pence was, away from where some of the senators were.
Officer Goodman passes Senator Mitt Romney and directs him to turn around in order to get to safety.
In that split second is seen basically making sure that Mitt Romney doesn't go the wrong direction.
And was that your first time seeing that video, Senator?
Yes, it was, yeah.
What did you feel like watching that?
That I was very fortunate indeed that Officer Goodman was there to get me in the right direction.
You know, we have this sense in the United States that our leaders in government are so protected. Right. You know, we've seen Secret Service that travels three deep with someone like the vice president. You know, those big black SUVs, not to mention helicopters. And I mean, we live in a country where we take off our shoes at the airport. There's an idea that we keep people safe and we definitely keep the leaders of our government safe. And to see in just these unbelievable images, once again, leaders in our government running for their lives, being escorted away.
Right.
It rattled people in the room.
And like Mike Pence, yeah, he's got six Secret Service agents or whatever, but like that would have been no match for the dozens at that point, maybe even hundreds of people that were not that far away from him.
Who were chanting about hanging him.
They were within 100 feet of where the vice president was sheltering with his family.
And who were, as Democrats said over and over during their arguments, the insurrectionists were responding to the president's tweets that were specifically targeting and naming Mike Pence that day.
At 2:24 p.m., he tweeted, quote, "Mike Pence didn't have the courage to do what should have been done
to protect our country and our Constitution."
The insurgents amplified President Trump's tweet attacking the vice president with a bullhorn.
So you mentioned sort of how shaken it would make you. Like, what was the reaction in the chamber? Because, you know, these are a lot of, some of them are Republicans. They're literally watching tape of themselves, and they're going to be asked in a couple days, have you changed your mind? Are you voting to convict the president? Does this shape that at all?
I think that for some, they very quickly turn to pretty standard talking points about the constitutionality of the entire proceedings. Show.
But let me tell your viewers, the not guilty vote is growing after today. I think most Republicans found the presentation by the House managers offensive and absurd.
But I think that there were others that left the chamber who did seem to be taking the video to heart.
I don't see how Donald Trump could be reelected to the presidency again.
I'm struck by the comments that Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa, he said that he felt he was oblivious that day to just the whole scene. From his vantage point, he couldn't see everything. And clearly the video, sort of the entirety of it, had gotten to him in some way. Senator Thune from South Dakota said that he thought the House managers had done an effective job of presenting the president's tweets in a timeline leading up that he said was effective. So I think that they're, that these are people. They are weighing evidence to varying degrees, and they are reliving those hours in very different ways.
Yeah, even beyond the masks, you could see some of these senators reliving in their eyes exactly how impactful this all was. All right, Mary Alice Parks there at the Capitol. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
We're going to rebuild our alliances. We're going to re-engage the world and take on the enormous challenge we face, dealing with the pandemic, dealing with global warming, and again, standing up for democracy and human rights around the world.
So far in the Biden era, one of the president's clear priorities has been to reach out to foreign governments to affirm alliances. But the question has been, how will he treat countries that aren't acting like allies, countries that are flouting international law? Well, yesterday, the Biden administration announced it intends now to punish those military leaders in Myanmar who just perpetrated what the White House is now calling a coup. ABC's Connor Finnegan covers the State Department. Connor, it wasn't just a vocabulary change here. Like, they announced they're going to sanction people, too. How big of a deal was this?
Brad, this has the potential to be a really big deal, but oddly, we don't really have any of the details yet.
The military must relinquish power it seized and demonstrate respect for the will of the people of Burma.
Biden said yesterday that he will sign the executive order later today, which will authorize the sanctions. So far, no one has actually been sanctioned. But it will include the military's leadership, their families, and their personal assets, which could have a bit of a bite to it, as well as the $1 billion in funds that Myanmar holds in the U.S.
We're freezing U.S. assets that benefit the Burmese government while maintaining our support for healthcare, civil society groups, and other areas that benefit the people of Burma directly.
But at the end of the day, this is a country that has sort of prided itself for years on taking this strong stance against the rest of the world. It almost sort of resembles North Korea in that isolationist way. So this external pressure may not really do anything at the end of the day. Mm. What will matter, though, is the internal pressure. We've seen sustained protests for days now. In fact, just yesterday, we saw dozens of police officers actually defect, joining protesters, using their police shields to shelter protesters from the military's water cannons. This is a military leadership that has been entrenched in power since 1989 and has faced waves of protests over the years. But if there's any cause for hope for Myanmar's democracy at this point, it's that the country has had a taste of democracy for the last few years. Hmm. People have cell phones and internet access. They have greater freedoms and better economic opportunities, educational opportunities, and they don't want to turn the clock back. And so the U.S. standing with them by announcing these sanctions really gives them a cause for hope that the world is watching and will make Myanmar's military pay the cost.
Oh, that's interesting. That, like, the action from the U.S. here, will it affect the military itself? Like, maybe not. But could it inspire people there on the ground? That could be an actual effect of all this. Connor, I guess I am kind of wondering, though, is Myanmar the actual audience here? Like, I'm sure the State Department cares very much about the citizens of that country, but is it possible that the Biden administration is also playing to other countries, in, you know, the international community?
I think it's both.
Part of our effort is not just unilateral action from the United States, but also working with our partners and allies, including in the region, to determine the right ways to put pressure on and have engagement.
The international community is watching the Biden administration. This has been called Biden's first foreign policy crisis. So how he responds to it and what red lines he sort of lays down will be watched by other countries.
As protests grow, violence against those asserting their democratic rights is unacceptable, and we're going to keep calling it out. The people of Burma are making their voices heard, and the world is watching.
They obviously want the restoration of democracy in Myanmar. They want long-term civilian rule and stability. But this message will be seen in other capitals, that the U.S. is now taking a hard line in defense of democracy. We saw during the Trump administration, repeatedly, they pulled their punches with certain countries on this very issue. They said that they had a more pragmatic or realistic approach. But Biden is saying now that democracy, human rights will be at the center of U.S. foreign policy again.
And I was going to say, across town in D.C., Democrats calling what happened on January 6th, this attempted coup, the White House would not use that phrase. They are not going there. In fact, they're really not weighing in on the impeachment at all, which has led to some Democrats saying, hey, is it weird that Biden is willing to come out against coups in other countries, but not his own? Tricky politics in D.C. Connor Finnegan keeping a watch on it all. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
And one last thing.
To honor America and perform our national anthem, please welcome...
The national anthem has become a kind of fraught moment at sporting events, right? What once felt like this kind of predictable ceremony is now full of uncertainties. Is everyone standing around me? Are statements being made? What are the statements trying to say?
This morning, there was growing controversy over a decision by the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, Mark Cuban, to not play the national anthem at the home games.
Well, recently, reporters noticed that the Dallas Mavericks weren't having any of these moments because there was no anthem. It's easy to miss when fans aren't generally being allowed into games, but when asked about it, the owner, Mark Cuban, said, no, they just haven't been playing the anthem at all.
Cuban and the Mavs now trending on Twitter. Here are some of the reactions. Quote, great decision by Mark Cuban. Others should follow his lead. Someone wrote, I won't spend another cent on the Dallas Mavs. And finally, I hope the fans sing it anyway. Hashtag USA.
The real issue is how do you express the voices of those who feel the anthem doesn't represent them or causes them consternation?
From one perspective, that's a statement in and of itself, right? If a player stayed in the locker room for the anthem, that would say something. Here's the owner skipping the whole thing and basically making it so that everyone else skips it too. But Cuban also raises the point. Why is a national anthem a necessary part of a sporting event?
You know, a lot of people said that they don't understand why, you know, the anthem is played prior to a game. Others said, you know, it shouldn't be played prior to the game. Others said it didn't.
This has been in our DNA for a long time, though. The first recorded instance of the Star Spangled Banner being sung at a sporting event was a baseball game during the Civil War. Northern folks were feeling patriotic. And wartime was really the reason it became ingrained.
It was during the seventh inning stretch that the military band struck up an impromptu rendition of the Star Spangled Banner. Red Sox third baseman Fred Thomas, playing the series while on leave from the Navy, snapped to attention in a military salute.
Fans sung it during the 1918 World Series during World War I, and then it became a kind of standard pregame thing during World War II. Smash cut to a few decades later when we're asking celebrities to sing. We're unfurling huge flags, we're having military flyovers because what?
Absolutely. Amazing and inspiring.
Why are sports the place we choose to do this? Some experts have said sports are the place where Americans come to watch battle, a war with fewer casualties. You literally show up to declare allegiance to something, to say we're all rooting for the same team, which is why it's not really the same vibe at a rock concert or at a movie theater. But the Dallas Mavericks are now under the spotlight. Yesterday, the NBA put out a statement saying each of its teams are expected to play and stand for the anthem every game.
We didn't make any decision to never play the national anthem. That wasn't the case at all. We didn't cancel the national anthem.
Mark Cuban says he wasn't planning on banning it the whole season, but he wasn't going to make players deal with it until fans were back in the stands. So what will Cuban do? It's unclear because he often follows a different but very real American tradition of not doing what you're told. It's also interesting because no one really realized a few years ago what Colin Kaepernick was doing until like a couple games later. Everyone put their heads up. It took a month and a half for anyone to see what was happening in Dallas. More on all this at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. You can also follow live impeachment coverage throughout the day. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.